Hello, friends. Welcome to another episode of the Liberty Weekly podcast. I'm your host, as always, Patrick McFarland. This one is episode 179. And for this show, I am joined by Kyle Ancelone and Will Porter of Conflicts of Interest, longtime friends of the Liberty Weekly podcast and also featured at antiwar.com and the Libertarian Institute. How's it going, guys? It's been too long.
Yeah, doing great. Pat, I don't know. I think, Will, this might have been our first show that we both did an interview as guests on the same time, and that was probably like 5 years ago. So it's great to be back doing it again. I always enjoy Liberty Weekly.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. I always like when you come on our show, and I'm kind of on call right now, so if I have to dip out in the middle of this conversation, I might have to do that. But yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, totally cool, man. When you can get Will Porter, you get Will Porter. Am I right?
Hell yeah.
So we've been pretty busy. Well, at least you guys have been pretty busy in the last couple of days. I'm just getting back from family vacation. So, you know, I go on vacation and all hell breaks loose. So do you guys want to break down kind of, I know you've been covering very closely kind of the fall of the Afghan government. So can we start, I don't know, like a few weeks ago, maybe?
I'll let Will kick it off and then I'll jump in.
Yeah, sure. So, starting a couple of weeks ago, I guess it's smartest to start when the Taliban's offensive really kind of ramped up. They first launched an offensive, as they usually do in the spring. It's sort of their seasonal offensive, but it really started picking up at the beginning of August, I think. That was when they started taking their first provincial capitals, like the major, you know, regional centers of Afghanistan. They had kind of, you know, they controlled a lot of districts in the countryside up until that point, but really 2 weeks ago is when they really started just tearing through all these cities. And yeah, I mean, they took over the last 2 weeks pretty much all of the major cities in Afghanistan, you know, Kunduz, Kandahar, Herat, Mazar Sharif, the Lashkargah, the provincial capital of Helmand province. And it's kind of just been, you know, building up ever since then. And it did sort of, you know, come to a head with the fall of Kabul. But yes, starting 2 weeks ago or so, that is really when the fighting started intensifying. And I guess I will say too, there hasn't been too much resistance from the Afghan military. Honestly, the Taliban's kind of just been, you know, rolling into these cities and taking them. But go ahead, Kyle.
I interrupted. Oh yeah, I was just gonna jump in and say that Pat Wilson, I'll send you a link to this tweet that Will actually found, where they have a table of when all the Afghan capitals fell. And just to look at that, you will get a sense of how quickly this happened. Now, as you know, Will was saying there, that there hasn't been all that much fighting. I'm not sure if anybody really died in the battle for Kabul. In fact, more people may have died trying to get on planes at the Kabul airport at this point than have actually died fighting for the city with the Taliban. Now, I mean, they may be carrying out hits and executions in private, but other than I saw a few videos, the UN has claimed that they were carrying out some reprisal attacks and stuff like that. But generally speaking, it has seemed like this has happened in a rather quick and bloodless way, where the Taliban were just able to swoop through. And I don't think know yet how they cut all these deals and made everything happen. But it was either by the surrender and lack of motivation from the Afghan government or an Afghan army, or the Taliban cutting some pretty savvy political deals. But this thing went quick.
Yeah, and I know that from, so in Fool's Errand, Scott was kind of tweeting this out the other day, but in Fool's Errand, he says that these rural districts are really, you know, that the Taliban really has a presence in these rural districts that has been pretty long standing, is my understanding. Is that right?
Yeah, they're like pashtun areas, especially like in the south of the country or in the east, in the east and the south, Kandahar, Helmand, these are all like very heavy pashtun areas, and they're areas where I don't know what percentage of, you know, this area was controlled by the Taliban before, but it was like the Helmand province was the capital city was controlled by the Afghan National Army, but the rest of the thing was controlled by the Taliban because they're just dominant in that area. Now, it is, I guess from the reporting that I've seen, and Will, maybe you could comment to say differently, but it seemed like a lot of the fighting in Afghanistan over the past couple of weeks was actually for Herat, Kunduz, Kandahar, and Lashkargah, which I don't know if I were maybe a military strategist for the Afghan army, I would have thought to give up those cities in very heavy pashtun areas and try to just defend areas that are, you know, more Uzbek and Tajik and you know, people who are more sympathetic to the Afghan government, which I don't think you find a whole lot of Afghan government sympathies in the Helmand province. And then all these other provinces just collapsed almost without a fight. And just very curious how all this works out. And I'm hoping that we get, you know, some great reporter, whether it's like a Gareth Porter or a Patrick Coburn or maybe an Anand Gopal, that's able to like get the sources on the ground and figure out just what the hell happened and how it happened, because that's going to answer a whole lot of questions. Cause, you know, there's a lot of rumors swirling around about, you know, what was this, the Taliban like carrying out bribes, or the U.S. and CIA involvement, or Ghani just being a straight-up crook and stealing all the money and getting the hell out of town. I saw a report from Bloomberg today. This was pretty interesting. And they had some unnamed sources from the Dawa talks. These are the talks that were going on between the Afghan government and the Taliban up until this past weekend. And apparently they had worked out a deal where Ghani was going to resign, and then there was going to be a two-week transitional government and ceasefire before the Taliban officially took control. And according to the Bloomberg report, don't know how true this is, Ghani fleeing and leaving town caused this whole thing to collapse. And then it kind of created a situation where there was no force at all, government security force in Kabul at all. And so at least somewhat maybe reasonably under the pretext of needing to provide security to prevent looting. Because look, if the president leaves, there's all kinds of crazy stuff in the presidential palace that people could go in and steal. Like, you don't want widespread looting in the area. And so that was the Taliban, at least I think according to like their narrative, their excuse to come in. Now, how much truth is in all this is interesting, but well, I don't know if they have anything on all that.
Yeah, I will say, Pat, you had asked about like the Taliban's control of the rural districts. And SIGAR, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction, sort of the main watchdog for the war, they put out their report in late July. And they said that between June and July, the Taliban started controlling, they doubled their control of districts in Afghanistan. And it ended up nearly being half of the country at the end of July. However, at that point, the SIGAR had said that they did not control any provincial capitals. And so, yeah, they did do a big sweep between June and July, took a lot of like these rural districts. And only at the beginning of August really did they start pushing into these major cities. But unfortunately, I got an editor calling me. I do have to go, guys. But thanks for having me. It's been great.
Of course. Thanks a lot, Will. Take care.
Take care, y'all.
So Kyle, one thing I wanted to get your opinion on is because we saw Biden address the country this afternoon just a few hours ago, and it really seemed like he did. There was a lot of good language there, and I think we should touch on that. But I also think that he really put the blame on the Afghans themselves. And I've seen some talk on Twitter. I don't know exactly how fair that is, because at least from my perspective, it seems like, you know, a lot of people are saying it's their unwillingness to defend their own country, that they're just ungrateful or lazy or cowards or something like that. But knowing the situation, right, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not an expert on Afghanistan, but it seems to me like what you have is a mashup of ethnic minorities who have more allegiance to their ethnic areas than they do to some kind of national Afghan government.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess that's at least the government in Kabul. Now, how I know before the U.S. came in and like destroyed the Taliban when they had control over most of the country in 2001, that there was a Northern Alliance of all of these minority groups. And so there is some, you know, inner sympathies between the groups. It's not like there's maybe no interest in forming some kind of coalition, but there certainly wasn't in the past week in Afghanistan. I mean, the Taliban just moved through. You know, something to point out that we don't know exactly what happened in Afghanistan, but it seems like relatively that the Afghan people in maybe a general sense kind of chose the course of peace. I mean, this was a lot of territory to change hands with, for as much territory that changed hands, not that many people were killed in all of this. And so you know, there maybe could have been assessments you know, from some, you know, military commanders, you know, just local tribal leaders in Afghanistan, that look, you know, maybe we don't exactly love the Taliban, but hanging out, you know, dealing with the Taliban is better than fighting a protracted civil war. And so there could have been some of that. And I don't think that's necessarily something to shame the Taliban for as being cowards or something to, choose after. And look, this isn't a country that's like had 5 years of war, 10 years of war. I mean, it's been like 50 years now. The Soviets killed a million, then there was civil war, and then the U.S. invasion. I mean, this is a lot of foreign interference. And then, but the bigger problem with that analysis, I think, is it was the U.S. that built this government. And so if the U.S. picked incompetent Afghans that couldn't run the country and build the government, like apparently Ashraf Ghani was and so many other people, Karzai is known to have a lot of problems. A lot of the Afghan warlords we've dealt with and that have been involved in the government, even like Dostum, are, known for being torturers. We're on the run and tortured people in cruel ways in Afghanistan. Whenever you build, if you don't build a solid house, right, and then it falls over, even if the homeowner was maybe like a poor homeowner and didn't do correct maintenance, if you don't build a solid house, it's going to fall apart. And this house didn't even, actually last until the builders left. They were still, maybe putting on the final touches on the paint coat, and a big storm came and blew the thing over. And so, maybe the homeowner was a mess and didn't do the dishes, but it is on the U.S. I mean, just look at the helicopter. The attack helicopter is one great example where for years and years, the U.S. Used these Soviet-made helicopters. And in like the 2012, 13, they finally got to the point where the Afghans were able to like use and maintain these helicopters. But by this time, the U.S. policy towards Russia was changing, and we were sanctioning Russia. And so the U.S. couldn't buy these parts for the Afghan government. The Afghan can't buy the parts because you can't have your proxy government buying parts. And so like we had to do these backdoor deals where India was buying it from Russia, and then they are giving it to the Afghan army to get around the sanctions. And so they switched over to the Black Hawk helicopters. And of course, I'm sure there was interest in the U.S. Attack helicopter lobby that was very happy to increase demand for attack helicopters. And so, with all these different interests, you end up having Black Hawks. Well, the Afghans still can't use and maintain those helicopters. And so now you severely, nerf the one advantage that the Afghan, army had over the Taliban, the Air Force, because, the helicopters. I think Sopko in his last report says something like only 30% or 36% of those helicopters were functional at that time. And again, that would be like if you were a U.S. military commander, I would say the one thing you would want to do is make sure that the Air Force, their Air Force is there, because if they could, have the air superiority, they could prevent, the Taliban moving a lot of, troops in certain areas, and all of this was gone. Another interesting note, while I'm just talking about air power, apparently the U.S. hasn't carried out airstrikes in Afghanistan in a few days. I thought that was interesting. So it doesn't seem like it was just the Afghans in this case that decided not to fight. The U.S. decided not to carry out airstrikes. And I'm sure that, the Taliban don't have an unlimited number of fighters. And so as they're securing all these areas, they had to leave some number of fighters there, right? But then also when you look, they had to move all their other fighters into these other areas. And so, I would think if the U.S. really wanted to fight about and they're carrying out airstrikes in Afghanistan, they would have stopped, maybe Taliban troop movements and stuff like that. But they haven't carried out strikes in several days. It's not like they were bombing the Taliban that were headed towards Kabul.
It seems to me that some of the last airstrikes were destroying U.S. equipment that they had left behind. Do you have any reports of that?
I've seen tons of video, right? And some of it's like seems to be more from confirmed sources that, this was definitely the Taliban at this time capturing it, because I'm sure there's a lot of incentive for people to take videos, because the Taliban have in the past 5 years taken several cities for a short period of time, Farah City, Kunduz, Ghazni, again, in the past 5 years. And when they've taken the cities, they've left pretty quickly afterwards, but they have seized military equipment. And so, there are potential videos out there of people who definitely look like the Taliban, like taking equipment from years past. But there's definitely been some of it happening. They've definitely seized some high-tech equipment, including like $3.2 million U.S. drones and U.S. Humvees. And there's definitely been some helicopters with Taliban, you know, seen in the you know, pilot, co-pilot seat. Now, I have, you know, heard, and it would make sense that a lot of the equipment that was left behind because for what, you know, it was missing parts, it wasn't functioning. Now, maybe the thing was just out of gas, maybe there wasn't enough people to hop in it, maybe they just forgot it and left it. You know, there were no helicopter pilots, so it was got left. So it's certainly possible that there are functioning helicopters and, you know, armored vehicles, advanced vehicles, advanced weapons. Certainly there's some. Now, is, you know, every video of a Taliban guy walking through a field of, you know, just dozens of vehicles lined up, are all those vehicles definitely working in front? I don't know. Did the U.S. maybe take out some of those with airstrikes since? That's definitely possible too.
Well, see, to me, I guess the reason why I highlight that is because it seems like it's the height of folly, right? I mean, you're using that whole thing about, I don't know, a soldier who doesn't make $100,000 in a year shooting a $100,000 rocket at a, you know, a hut of someone who doesn't make, you know, I don't know, $3 or $4 a year. But to use U.S. munitions to destroy U.S. equipment so it doesn't fall to the Taliban is just, just kind of...
Well, I mean, you know, one of the few things that I guess the U.S., they knew the Afghan government, say, was going to be withdrawing from the Kandahar airfield, I'm kind of surprised that they didn't coordinate airstrikes to destroy everything, at least not to have this, you know, terrible PR. I mean, you know, Trump got some bad PR in Syria when you know, he withdrew from the, like, the northern Syria area. Not because he didn't withdraw from all of northeastern Syria, but he withdrew from some of it. And the areas that he withdrew from, they bombed some of the bases to destroy the equipment. It doesn't seem like that happened, at least not extensively. Now, maybe it fell too fast that there just wasn't enough air assets with enough bombs to take out all this stuff, right? I'm not sure about the logistics here. I could, you know, be wrong or mistaken about something, but that is probably the one thing that, you know, if you're the U.S., it seems like it would be almost impossible not to prevent. It is in some way stopping that from happening. Either by destroying the weapons, making sure the Afghan army gets them out there, or, you know, have the Afghan army have the guys throw toss a grenade in every truck before you leave it. As long as the thing looks burnt out and on fire and not easy to drive, even if they're able to salvage a whole bunch of stuff out of those trucks, at least then you're not, you know, giving the PR blow and stuff. And so I do think it's very strange and something to definitely look into keeping an eye on, especially when you would think that the Pentagon would have very specific contingency planning for this because this happened in Iraq. Like, it's not like this is something that was completely unpredictable. This happened in Iraq, where the army that the U.S. trained up there, the Iraqi army, they bled away. And now, in that case, I guess the U.S. maybe wasn't in the country and didn't have all the assets there, you know, as it was falling, like, you know, we do in Afghanistan, because the U.S. had actually left Iraq a couple years. Of course, we armed and trained up all the jihadists in Syria during that time. You know, that's the blowback that caused this and a whole bunch of other things from the Iraq war. But, you know, just, you know, make it simple. This should have been something that the Pentagon considered, you know, looking at 2014, 2013 Iraq, and had some kind of plan or idea of how the hell they were going to make sure we didn't have this calamity happen again.
Well, that was one thing I was going to mention earlier, too, is that I'm sure that the Taliban had their eyes on Iraq in 2013 and 2014 and saw what happened there. And maybe that was a big decision as to why they marched in so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the interesting things was a few weeks ago when the Taliban really started their offensive, the Taliban commander pointed out that they weren't taking major cities, but that they were getting to the point where they were really surrounding major cities because the offensive had just gone so much better than planned. And so a lot of this ground war may have been laid before this, I guess, present week is, you know, something worth considering there. But What was your original question? I'm sorry, I got off track.
Oh, no, I was just saying that it seems like part of the decision to march into Kabul so quickly might have just been because they saw what happened in Iraq and wanted to, you know, prevent a situation where basically bad anarchy happens, you know?
Right, right. No, and absolutely, especially in a situation like this where so much of the wealth in Afghanistan is the money that the U.S. gave to the Afghan government. And so while the Afghan people have suffered and have been victims of the U.S. war in Afghanistan for all these years, and the U.S. has poured trillions of dollars into that country, if you're just, you know, the Afghan baker on the street corner or whatever the hell, like, I don't know how much you benefited from that, unless I did read a story earlier about how one guy had his bakery like right across from the airport or the embassy or something like that. But, you know, for the most part, people haven't, regular Afghans haven't benefited from this. And so if, you know, Ghazni leaves it as palace and you know that there's like some, are suspect there's some gold or something valuable in there, like, why, you know, are you just gonna let it sit there for somebody else to take? I mean, you know, whatever corrupt politician moves into that building nets doesn't really have any right to that either. So you know, it creates these really bad situations. And at least there wasn't like major looting in chaos, at least not so far from the video we see in Kabul. And, you know, very interesting today, you have Richard Engel from MSNBC and, oh man, what is her name? Crystal Wade, maybe? I'm sorry if I'm getting her name wrong. Something similar to that. She's a female reporter for CNN. And so she's kind of made a show that when the Afghan government was in power over the weekend, she was, you know, dressed like a, almost like a casual, you know, woman, like not like going out to the bar casual, but like, you know, going to the park casual, you know, just like a nice like shirt on. And, you know, she's got short hair and it's all like done and exposed and everything like that. And then after the Taliban take control, she's wearing a all black burqa with like her head, all of her hair covered. Although it's not like it's the full masked face covering. She does have like her full face exposed. But it, you know, is a lot of covering. She's, you know, been making, you know, a big thing about that. But as a woman, female journalist, she's walking around Kabul filming, and it, you know, I'm sure the Taliban aren't as stupid as she thinks they are. And they do understand what she's doing, walking around in that black burqa, talking about how, you know, she was dressed, you know, in pink and in no sleeve like vest last week or whatever. They're not like being mean to her or anything. In fact, you know, this lady, it doesn't get it so much. She's standing there, and that's these Taliban fighters, and they're not like old commander guys. They're just like some guys standing, some Taliban fighters that are like guarding at a checkpoint on a street corner, right? And they're sitting there chanting death to America, and she's like, it's utterly bewildering. They're very friendly, and they're chanting death to America. And it's like, yeah, they're not chanting death to Americans. They're chanting death to America because America's foreign policy is killing the Taliban and, you know, all the people of Afghanistan, is absolutely brutalizing them. And so, you know, they don't hold anything against you personally, lady, because you're not the ones dropping the bombs on them. But it's kind of hard not to at least be, I'm sure, for the Taliban to at least, you know, be America is the enemy that they've been fighting in this war for the past 15 years. And so, you know, it does show something that we have, you know, these Western reporters, you know, very, you know, white women who, you know, she's obviously got a lot of makeup on, again, walking around downtown Kabul. It's not like they're taking her out of there or anything. So, yeah, this is her saying that's these Taliban fighters. Clarissa Ward, that's her name.
Clarissa, okay, yeah. And I think that's a perfect segue because, and sorry for the audio clip there for a second, but it's a perfect segue. What do you think overall of the media coverage of this event?
So this, we have a good friend, Joanne Leone. She's been on my podcast a bunch. I think she's been on your show. I think we've both been on her show, Around the Empire. If you don't watch it, check it out. One of the things that she's pointing out is that this is the most hostile she has seen the media against Biden in quite some time. And that definitely seems to be the case. Now, there's a lot of really bad images here. The withdrawal from Afghanistan was completely botched by the administration in an unacceptable way. I think Edward Snowden had a tweet saying that, you know, it shows that would have made a huge difference had they started this a week before. And, you know, while it may not have been completely obvious a week ago that Kabul was going to fall in a week, it was, you know, becoming more and more obvious that the situation in Kabul was becoming increasingly, like, you know, unstable. And it doesn't even seem like they were in the stages of being ready to move people out of the city. I mean, you know, the scenes we have here of hundreds of Afghans running along a C-17 cargo plane. There's another image of what must be 800 people in the back of one of these C-17 cargo planes. I mean, it looks like the most uncomfortable situation you could possibly be in. And it just shows that they were in no way prepared for this. One of the things that Biden said during his speech, getting back to that, is that they had contingency plans in place. And obviously they didn't, because it's chaos. It's anarchy in the bad way at the Kabul airport, which is kind of funny because that's the only part of Afghanistan not under Taliban control.
And I know that we were discussing this, you know, you, myself, and Joanne were discussing the coverage, at least of the airport, just a few minutes ago. But do you have any thoughts about, of course, the media who is there, who does not want us to leave Afghanistan, is going to take shots that make it look like drum up the chaos or feature it a little bit more. Any observations that you've made on that specifically?
So, I would just remind everybody to continue to be skeptical of any footage you see coming out of Afghanistan. Because, you know, for somebody who doesn't live in Afghanistan, even soldiers who have been to Afghanistan, unless, you know, you've been there for a long period of time and or have been there recently, you know, things change and look differently. And so it could be hard to, you know, identify and make sure everything's true. Afghan journalists, I Tolo News, I thought, was doing a pretty good job. Reuters still has some people they contract with. I feel, you know, comfortable that whatever CNN is showing, like, you know, in Clarissa Ward's, you know, exposés and stuff, it's not like, you know, they're CGI or Photoshopping anything. So whatever footage they get is probably real. Although, you know, if like they're like, there's a shooting and these five people died, I would be skeptical if, you know, they're footage suddenly picks up at one point and, you know, misses some contests or something like that. So I'm always skeptical. They have this footage of some people who are apparently killed at the Kabul airport, maybe shot, maybe something else. If you look at the actual bodies that they have laying there, and it seems to be like only like a very short video and stills of this, there's no blood, and it's a lot of bodies not to have any blood or have, you know, because if that many people got shot, you know, maybe somebody would have stopped and tried to provide some medical aid at some point. Or if they were all like shot in the head or something like that, and nobody's stopping to provide medical aid because they're obviously dead, there would obviously be some blood. Now, people could die by being trampled to death in these crowds, and that's not impossible. But when you look at the kind of the bodies on the ground, you don't see them maybe in the condition that you would necessarily think to see a body that's been trampled to death. That being said, there could be other reasons, like they could have had medical episodes and they were just kind of moved there because, you know, you and your family, right? You have your two kids and your wife with you, right? You're trying to do everything you can to get on a plane. Old ladies, you know, it has a stroke and dies next to you, right? Like, what do you do? Like, can't really bury her, right? You know what I mean? You gotta get your kids out of the country. Like, that's what's important to you. Like, you're not being callous. It's not that you hate the old lady or anything, but, you know, at some point your family matters more than anything else. And so, you know, maybe it's possible that the bodies just kind of got drug off and left there. There's so many possibilities of what could happen. And so, you know, when you just have a still photo and people are like, oh, there's dead bodies, maybe.
So another thing that I wanted to ask you about too is, and maybe this is kind of jumping the gun a little bit, is what do you think the prospects are for stability within the Taliban regime itself? Like, are we going to see a regime that comes into power and just doesn't have the capability to keep order and to actually establish a government? Because it seems like, I mean, at least in terms of governance, the Taliban, you know, they've been around for quite some time.
I honestly have no idea. I guess that it's worth mentioning that the Taliban have kind of put out there that they're not carrying out reprisals, and you know, that people who worked for the U.S. aren't going to be, even who worked for the U.S. military aren't going to be, like, murdered and stuff like that. It seems, you know, at least there's been some evidence, you know, put forward that the Taliban did carry out some reprisals. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if they did. I'm not sure of all the situations. And then, you know, just because, like, the Taliban leadership says we're not carrying out reprisals, it doesn't mean that some Taliban commander in some district in, you know, Farah province that has seen brutal fighting or something like that and some nasty execution and tactics doesn't go out and take retaliation and execute 50 people. I mean, that kind of, like, you know, so just because they're trying to maybe be less extreme doesn't mean that certain commanders and factions of the Taliban couldn't still be more extreme. I don't think it's, I mean, it's obviously somewhat cohesive of an organization, but I don't think it's, you know, top down, everybody's always in line and everything like that. But, you know, the Taliban at least seem to recognize that there is a value in appearing to be less brutal than they were last time. And, you know, that is something, right? Like, last time they were carrying out public executions of women, and it wasn't something that they were trying to really hide or downplay. It was just, you know, the society that they had. This time, it doesn't seem like maybe they would go that route. Now, it's not necessarily better if they just decide to kill all their women in private. But if they, you know, do recognize that these things at least look bad, maybe they'll also try to not do it as much, or maybe there's been some realization or maturity of the Taliban movement. I mean, that's not impossible. Militant groups become less militant over time, or not as a rule, but in instances, if you look at something like the IRA or the FARC, you know, our groups have, like, kind of famously demilitarized and to some extent have joined politics. And not that maybe the FARC doesn't have still some former members or even, you know, some people still claiming to be in FARC who do bad things in Colombia, but that is different than having this entire guerrilla group that's essentially carrying out terrorist tactics, right? And so I don't know what we're going to see in Afghanistan. Something tells me that it's going to be a situation where they're just gonna make themselves, like, a click better than Saudi Arabia, right? So we're not going to publicly execute our women. You know, maybe we have women in Afghanistan can't drive or something like that, but, you know, we're not going to do anything that the Saudis don't do and just try to, like, walk that line or something. But who knows?
Yeah, and I guess one of my main concerns is, like, okay, you have a force, and I know that the Taliban, like, from my understanding, that they have at least areas under their control, and they, you know, they, is it that they rule in those areas and they are, like, I don't, like, a state, like, they enforce the law and do dispute resolution and that kind of stuff?
I think so. I think that's part of the reason that you know, there is some appeal with the Taliban, is because being, I guess, more, like, tied to a code rather than the Afghan government, which there's really no loyalty to, but there is some loyalty to, like, the Pashtun, the code and the Sharia law that the Taliban go by, that you're a little bit more consistent then. So, you know, this is something that was also seen in Somalia with the Islamic Courts Union, is just that, you know, and even Al-Shabaab in some areas, is just that, you know, they're more effective and less corrupt than whatever government is getting a whole bunch of aid from the U.S. Now, they may be more brutal, but some people don't mind brutality. I mean, how many Republicans that do you know that are, like, kill the drug dealers, right? They're like, yeah, people take heroin and overdose and die, and so you gotta kill all the pushers. right? I mean, that's really not anything all that much more than like extreme law than the Taliban believe in, you know, that kind of level of brutality. And so if you apply it consistently, there's something that's like respectful of people appreciate about that. Also, even if the Taliban are brutal and bad, you know, there is something, maybe the evil that you don't know, like that appeals whenever you're living in a really terrible situation in Afghanistan where they got like this boy play thing. They dress these boys up as girls and have them, you know, dance around and then they rape them. And, you know, I'm going to put a link in the show notes. I'm going to send you a link for anybody who wants to, who has like the fortitude to read it. Go ahead and check it out and see how cruel this is to the young boys, because it's really not something I want to discuss, but I read something today that really does like take it to another level. It's not just that, like, you know, this is a rape. It's like there's some medical issues that come of this because of the way it's done. And it's really terrible. And so once you understand that, you would understand why that, you know, maybe you're kind of worried about the Taliban, like, you know, doing something to your wife if she leaves the house unsupervised, but at the same time, they're not raping your boy. I don't know how you made the decision between those two groups. I'm thankful every day that you know, I had to choose between I don't have to choose, but we choose in the country between the Republicans and the Democrats. And, you know, they may do some terrible things to people, but, you know, you're not choosing between the Taliban and Dostum and, you know, the tribal elders of Afghanistan who raped the boys.
Yeah, and we had Danny Scherzen was just on the show, and I'm not recalling the name, but he was talking about that Bachiba culture.
Yeah. Yeah, he even had it. So there, this I love pointing this out because I think it's such a powerful thing that when I've had two veterans on the show in the past couple of months, Scott Spaulding, who's been on your show, and Danny Scherzen, who you said been on your show, I guess, too. Both of them, when I asked them this question, were basically almost like they didn't laugh because this isn't funny to either of them. But it was almost like, you know, laughing it off, kind of the level of serious that they're like, are you kidding me? Let me tell you about the people we've been backing and arming in Afghanistan. And so, you know, we've been choosing to take the side of the child rapists in this war. You know, we've been choosing to take the side of the drug dealers in this corrupt government, people who have just stolen. You know, it's not like the Afghan government treats women all that well. If you look at the Freedom House report from this past year when, you know, they were judging the Afghan government, and the Freedom House isn't like some libertarian group, it's not some non-interventionist group, this is I think a group that gets a lot of their funding from the U.S. government, but they rated it as a not free country with a score of 27 out of 100. It's, you know, in the bottom quarter, I think, of all countries on earth. And, you know, they give some, you know, U.S. enemy countries, I think, a unfairly low score and all of that. And so, you know, that they probably got a little bit of a curve and a benefit on that, you know, so, you know, that this isn't choosing between a white hat and a black hat. This is choosing between two black hats. And it's not just choosing between the two pad, it's arming and killing for one of them. We've been giving them billions, dropped trillions of dollars total, but like $88 billion directly has gone to the ANA. And military equipment, and that doesn't include all the, you know, all the people that the U.S. murdered on behalf of these people, innocent people at times, you know, the people fleeing the Kunduz hospital. We are going after Taliban. We're trying to kill Taliban for the Afghan government, and we killed a whole bunch of doctors and children and innocent people fleeing a hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, in 2015.
Yeah, and it's hard to like fathom just the type of moral depravity that took place in Afghanistan in the last 20 years. I mean, I've seen some estimates that up to 250,000 people have died. I think that was a DOD report or a Military Times report.
I think that's about where the Cost of War project puts the total deaths for Afghanistan and Pakistan. I do think that counts the drone war that was waged in Pakistan too.
Okay. Is there any indication to you that that's a conservative estimate?
You know, it's so hard to say, just because There are so many situations where you see these things that happen, and you know that it happened a lot more, and it just got reported and happened to break through this one time. And so who knows how many people died and how many people who are labeled combatants were actually civilians. Also, I'm an American, Pat. And so when somebody from a different country comes to your country and you're on your own property or your town's property with your own weapon, that doesn't necessarily make you a combatant in the sense that your life is then nothing. You know what I mean? Like, you're kind of still a civilian if you're just preventing somebody. You know why? If somebody breaks into your house, Pat, and you kill that person, does that make you a militant, or you're still a civilian? You're defending your property. That it's, you know, it's not the you know, the same thing in all these cases either, which I'm sure the U.S. chalked up a lot of, you know, men who weren't in, you know, Afghan villages that they lived in and worked in, who happened to own guns. You know, whenever they died, they just chalked them up as a militant death. You could watch videos, particularly from Australia. They've done some actually pretty good reporting, the Australian media, I think, despite facing quite a bit of pushback, at least at certain levels, from the government there. Investigations into war crimes. There's this one where they just murder a guy. Like, you know what I mean? You know, when you're a kid walking through the woods with like a 22 and you see a bird and you point at it and shoot it because you're a kid with a 22, that's the way they treat the lives of Afghans. And so if that's the way you treat them, you're not going to worry about counting them the right way if you count them as a militant and dismiss them and not have to worry about it. And then just again, how many situations like that happen and you just left the body or they buried it in a shallow grave?
Yeah, and that's like in my last episode, I did that, the documentary about moral injury. Towards the end, there's that Winter Soldier testimony where they just talk about, he said, this is my third confirmed kill. This was the man on the bike, and I shot him basically because I could. So we took his body, and we pulled it over the brick wall, and we threw his bike on top of him, and we just went to the next house, you know? I think that, I don't know if that was in Fallujah or not, but that was, obviously, it was Iraq. But it makes me wonder, you know, it seems like he said this happens all the time, and none of this was reported or counted. And, of course, not every U.S. soldier is doing that, I'm sure. But it happens, you know, and I'm sure the number of reported incidents like that is a lot lower.
Right. And then, you know, just all the bombs that were dropped, and especially the CIA was completely unaccountable in all this. Who knows how many people they killed, how many of them were innocent, how many of their drone strikes. You know, there's something that Daniel Hale talks about, right, is he watched a video where there's a car speeding down the road. They decide that only the driver was in it and he was trying to flee to Pakistan, so they decide to take a shot. They actually missed the vehicle, but they hit close enough that it sent shrapnel through the back of the vehicle, and I think it killed at least one, but maybe two young girls, right? And were they counted? Who knows, right? And, you know, maybe they were counted because Daniel Hale exposed this, but let's say it was a different one, a different situation. And, you know, this time the whole car was destroyed. It's out in the middle of nowhere, Afghanistan. And who's going to count it? Who's going to say anything?
Right. And a little bit on your comment about the CIA is the Empire Files had a good episode on, like, the Afghanistan CIA death squads. I'll try and remember to put that in the show notes page. I'm making a lot of work for myself.
You got to remind me to send you those links, because I definitely want people to check out the two that I've mentioned so far are pretty important stuff. Yeah.
Hang on a sec there, Kyle. Hey, everybody, and welcome to the portion of the show where I tell you how you can help support this content. Your one-stop shop is libertyweekly.net/support. There you can find a bunch of ways to support me monetarily, such as PayPal, Subscribestar, or Patreon. You can do that and also get access to great bonus content there. You can also go ahead and use my Rakuten cashback link. You can go through libertyweekly.net/cashback. Through there, it's kind of like honey, where you can get cash back on a lot of places you probably already shop anyways. So if you sign up through my link and you spend $30, you will get $30 and I will also get $30. So it's a win-win-win where we all win. You can also check out my columns on Substack. I've also set up an Amazon wish list. If you do /wishlist, you can find a bunch of books that I'd like to buy for the show. And if you buy some of those books, of course, it will be sent to me and I will use it on the show. Also, check me out at float.app where you can get some Patreon bonuses for cryptocurrency if you don't want to spend some of your hard-earned fiat money, I suppose. Also, I have some new writers for the Liberty Weekly. Scott Grayson is a writer who just published his first piece on the website the day that this is being recorded. So go check that piece out. What does constitutional interpretation mean anyway? It's a great primer on constitutional interpretation. Scott is also an attorney, so really worth checking out his work. Our other writer is Sean Leal. He's published two pieces on the website. If you're watching on Odyssey, which you should be, you can see I'm just pulling these pieces up on Liberty Weekly. So check those pieces out. Really excited to have a good writing staff. We have some more writers that are planning to join the website by the end of the month, I think, maybe early in September. So really excited for that. The other announcement that I'd like to make is that there is a new logo for Liberty Weekly. And you probably saw it in your podcatcher, but if you're watching the video version, you see the logo up here. Really excited for that. This was Ludwig von Mises' pieces designed this logo for me. So if you like it, go check out his work. He's on Twitter. You can probably find him by searching that. But look at that, man. I'm really excited. I haven't had a new logo in a long time. And the logo that I was using previously was actually one that I made myself on Canva. So it worked, but I certainly like this one. If you're looking on your podcatcher, you can see I got the Culpeper Minutemen flag, which I think is a little less boomer con than your regular old Gadsden. I got the classic Liberty Weekly logo, and there's a pretty foxy pinup style flash tattoo lady, kind of Lady Liberty, I guess you could say. So anyways, yeah, that's those are all the ways that you can support me. Really do appreciate all those ways if you would check that out, if you enjoy my content and find it valuable. Yeah, so keep your eyes out. I got another article planned for the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org/Patrick. All right, thanks for bearing with me there. Check out all those things, and we'll catch you next time. Yeah. Well, one quick comment. I know I got you. I want to be respectful of your time, but before we change the subject, I worry just that the Taliban is not capable. I mean, they've taken so much territory so fast, and maybe they've set up, you know, arrangements beforehand to have a transition period, but to actually to have a force that is mainly a guerrilla war fighting force try to all of a sudden become in a certain way an occupation force. And maybe it's that the Afghans are welcoming.
Well, they're trying to become a government.
Right, exactly.
I would say. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. And one thing I will point out that Scott Horton has made a point of on his show is that rather than the Taliban, and he has made this point like in the past year and a half, is rather than the Taliban when they take over coming in, destroying all the infrastructure and kind of doing, setting up their own thing, they just kind of put their own people in place. And so I think that is something that probably makes the transition a little bit smoother if they're really not, you know, if they're keeping like kind of all the services and everything in place, at least for now, and just, you know, it's, you know, new boss situation. And there's been at least a couple districts that I have seen the Taliban just put the same people back in charge after they surrendered. And so I'm not sure what kind of deals were cut to make that happen, but it is kind of interesting that you know the Taliban are willing to do that, and maybe it is something that if they're really maybe somebody sat down, read a hell of a lot of political books, and actually has an idea of like a real strategy of how to control Afghanistan, and maybe that is one way to do it, is to leave the regional people in control of the regions and just have them pay like a token or tribute to Kabul and leave it as kind of that, that is maybe one way that a very federal type system that would work better. But I'm not Afghan. I have no clue.
Right. Yeah. And I suppose we're not talking about, you know, Hillary Clinton and Haiti with the State Department's Haiti task force here. They're not, you know, trying to technocratically plan Afghanistan into, you know, like a boutique for certain.
Maybe, you know what, and the other option that the Taliban do is they go complete Sharia law mode. They, you know, they say we're going back to 2000. Everything, you know, is going to be the way in the, you know, most fundamental. And that could very much happen. You know, they're prior to 2001 and at, you know, certainly times through this war and even recently, the Taliban have been horrible bastards. And there's no reason really to, you know, if I were somebody who was living in Afghanistan, in my, you know, my life and my family's life was on the line, you know, it's not necessarily a gamble that I would feel comfortable taking that the Taliban are going to come in this time and feel some be any different. You know, now as an American that, you know, doesn't have like an emotional stake in it, I, you know, okay, personally say that, like, I don't even, like, you know someone whose life is at risk, right? So it's just kind of like I read about this situation, I spend a lot of time studying it, but I don't feel like I have necessarily in like a deep emotional attachment. But I so from my view, it seems like there's a chance that the Taliban could be less violent, but I definitely understand why people are so desperate in Afghanistan and don't want to chance it or don't believe it could happen, especially anybody who remembers their previous rule.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense to me. I also think that from my armchair perspective, it seems like it'd be against their interest to be overtly brutal and to crack down a whole lot.
In one sense, though, Pat, it depends on who the Taliban are interested in pleasing. Is it, you know, is it their interpretation of Allah that they're looking at pleasing? Is it the international community? Are they just looking at having a tight domestic grip of control? And so if they don't care at all about what the international community thinks, which I don't think is true, then, you know, maybe they'll start executing people in public because, you know, that is a good way to crack down, or maybe that does fit in with their interpretation of the Quran or whatever, you know, code that they want to live by. Not that necessarily represents Muslims. And I'm saying that their interpretation is the reason that they would do this. I don't know what exactly their motives are, and I'm guessing there's going to be a variety for different Taliban members and stuff like that. But I would hope that at least they would probably see like the international community and think, well, you know, not doing public executions is a way we could avoid, you know, condemning unnecessary wrath.
Right. Yeah. If that international community is something that they're worried about with their reputation. Right.
Or who knows, maybe they're just better people this time. Right? I mean, it seems like a long shot, but you never know. Like, you know, over time, again, groups can become less brutal. Yeah. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that it's completely optimistic or stupid to think that it could be at least somewhat better this time around.
And weren't they able last time, Kyle, to pretty much stamp out the poppy production in Afghanistan?
Yes. So if you look at a chart of poppy production in Afghanistan, like 2000, 2001, it really dips. And something I talked to Danny Shurgeon about on my show, you know, this guy is a former West Point professor. He's an Afghan war vet, a retired U.S. Army major. This is a writer for antiwar.com. This guy studies, lives, and knows this stuff. And, you know, he was pointing out that, you know, before 2001, there was no pressure in the international community for the Taliban not to carry out public executions. And I said, well, Danny, it's, you know, interesting because the, you know, international community did pressure the Taliban to stomp out poppy, and they seem to be interested in doing that. And so, you know, maybe this time around we say, screw the, you know, we don't care about the drug war. Produce that. That's not our interest. Just don't kill women. Maybe they'll do, you know what I mean? Maybe if you make that moderate of an ask and, you know, not make all these laundry list of demands and not the, you know, Taliban have elections and all this other stuff. But hey, don't kill women. Don't throw acid on them. We'll be good. I don't know.
Well, and then, I mean, on that end, it seems like the mission really went from, okay, let's catch these, like, what, Saudis and Egyptian nationals who did the September 11th attacks, and then all of a sudden the mission becomes liberating Afghan women?
I mean, the mission is never about Afghan women. The mission is about staying in Afghanistan, occupying Afghanistan. The women become the excuse when there's no other excuses. Again, in 2015, when, you know, the women, children, doctors in the Kunduz hospital that was run by Doctors Without Borders were bombed and strafed as they left. The U.S. didn't bother to really carry out a thorough investigation, hold anybody responsible, or in any way pretend like those lives were worth any more than the lives of some stray dog in, you know, a kill shelter that they're just going to put down. You know, there was really no interest in finding out, like, anything about these people. It was just a matter of covering it up and moving on, and their lives were absolutely worthless and meaningless to the Obama administration, the American people. You know what I mean? Like, nobody, Marianne Williamson, wasn't going on tirades on Twitter when the U.S. blew up 30 pine nut farmers in Afghanistan last year and didn't do anything, held nobody accountable, did nothing about it. Did those women matter at all? No, obviously not. So it's all about just staying longer. Now, in fairness to some people, they don't pay attention to this. I'm guessing Marianne Williamson falls into this category. And so, you know, suddenly on the news, they're like, oh my God, the Afghan women. And, you know, being somebody who, you know, thinks she cares about the plight of women, is suddenly like, oh no, the Afghan women, we have to save them. But you can't just get involved in the middle of a situation and pretend that you know what's going on and how to fix it. And that's what they're doing.
So we mentioned a little bit earlier, we were talking about like the international community. And of course, one thing that we've really covered, or at least I've really covered on this show, is the situation with China in Xinjiang and the Uyghurs there. And I know you and I, we've talked quite a bit about the Larry Wilkerson, you know, his speech at the Ron Paul Institute event about how there's 20,000 Uyghurs that fought in Syria on behalf of Al-Qaeda, maybe sent there by Turkey. He was saying a few months ago in April that these Uyghurs were headed back to Xinjiang and possibly being aided in their journey there through Afghanistan. So just to touch on that, I have this piece, and sorry, I'm kind of springing you on this, Kyle, but we have this piece from France 24, China ready for friendly relations with Taliban, welcomes Afghan development projects. And so I know, and we were talking with Joanne Leon too about this, that you know, basically, China has an interest in at least being friendly with the Taliban. And the reason for that is because they want stability in Afghanistan.
Yeah. So, well, here's at least what my thoughts on that are. And I haven't seen this particular article, so shoot it over to me so I can throw it in my news roundup tomorrow, Pat. But I know that I think a week or a week and a half ago, the Taliban sent a delegation and did meet with China. And from the public readout that we got from that, the Chinese, you know, concerns were stability and the Uyghur population, because there's this Eastern Turkmenistan Liberation Group, I think it is their name, that, you know, in part is, I think, in it's Pakistan, province of Afghanistan. It's the province of Afghanistan that cuts in between the Central Asian countries and Pakistan, and gives Afghanistan a border with China. And this, you know, so this province is somewhere where, you know, you'll find Chinese Uyghurs. And again, you know, some of these people in this particular group was actually labeled by the U.S. as a terrorist group up until 2018. And in fact, in 2017 or 2018, the Trump administration actually bombed this group in Afghanistan. And so, you know, they definitely are there, and it's definitely something that China would be interested in. You know, just like the U.S. would be interested in, like, if there was some rebel group that wanted to, like, you know, go to Texas and secede, and they were hanging out in northern Mexico, I think the U.S. would take a pretty keen interest in what was going on there. And so I think that's one of China's top interests in Afghanistan. I'm not saying that's all their interest. I'm not exactly as sold as everybody else is. Or not, I shouldn't say everybody else, but sold as a lot of people are on the whole China's going to be super interested in Afghanistan's metals and stuff like that, and all the minerals and other elements and useful natural resources that that country has. It's possible that with a stable Afghanistan, it does become profitable to start to extract those minerals. But we are talking about things in pretty remote and mountainous areas. And so I'm sure it's going to be expensive projects. And if you don't have stability, it's going to be very hard to do that. Maybe there's more interest in China. And, you know, for anybody looking at a map here, you see China on one hand and, you know, on one side of Afghanistan and Iran on the other. And so that could be a pretty good way for Iran to get oil or, you know, other resources that they made to China without having to go through the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and, you know, a couple of U.S. numbered fleets to get over to you know, Chinese ports. If you look at a map, look how much I'm sure time and energy that would save if you have a pipeline that runs from Iran to China rather than having to sail around India and Sri Lanka and Thailand and, you know, Malaysia down to Singapore and then up, I'm guessing, to like Shanghai or something like that as a port city. And you know, it seems like something that would be very profitable to China if it were something that was possible, but infrastructure is expensive in unstable regions. It makes it pretty hard to pull off. So something tells me that the Chinese relations with the Taliban will probably be the inverse of the Taliban relations with the Uyghur militant groups. And so if the Taliban kick out the Uyghur militant groups, then I think China will at least be friendly and kind of open to the Taliban. And if they're open arms to the Uyghur group, then the opposite. Now, kind of interesting, Pat, that this is somewhat similar to what the U.S. policy, at least in Afghanistan, could be. Where, look, if you guys don't let the Al-Qaeda boys and the jihadists come back, we're good with that. And in fact, you know, everybody likes to forget this, but last October, at least through last October, the U.S. was, you know, by special forces members, you know, kind of jokingly designating himself the Taliban's Air Force in their war against the Islamic State Khorasan group in Afghanistan, where they were willing to take out the jihadist boys in the Nangarhar province and work with U.S. and I don't know how much work with the U.S., but at least receive some U.S. support for drones on that. You know, it kind of seems to indicate that the Taliban may be willing to play ball with the world superpowers and keep out, you know, separatist groups from their country in order not to incur anybody's wrath again.
Well, and this goes back, I don't know, to the weeks after 2011, right, where Mullah Omar is talking about, at least we have Scott Horton writing about this in Fool's Errand, Mullah Omar talking about Osama bin Laden and kind of the relationship there. What's the quote about a chicken bone in my throat that I can't swallow or spit out? That was Mullah Omar, right?
Yes. And there, just while we're kind of, you know, bringing up quotes that I think are telling, it's either Wilkerson or Margulies who said that, you know, there was like an agreement between China and the U.S. that, you know, you get your terrorist guys and we get our terrorist guys, you know, meaning that for China was the Uyghurs and for the U.S. it was Al-Qaeda. And that was kind of like the way they were doing business in Afghanistan. But that certainly seems to at least have maybe shifted a little bit in recent years. Yeah.
I remember hearing that in one of Scott's 2014 interviews, I think. The April of this year interview. And it might have been in one of those interviews with Margulies that I quoted in my my piece on the Uyghur genocide investigation.
I believe it was.
It was one of those.
Yeah. Pat, can we shift over real quick? Because I want to mention before we have to go or wrap up here. I don't know how much time you have. I don't want to hijack your show. But there was an article by Ray McGovern that I wanted to point out to people. And it is one of the most important points that needs to be made right now. And that is hold the generals accountable this time. We cannot let these people get away with this again. They have lied to the American people. Now, some of us knew better. But generally, they lied to us over the past 20 years, said this wasn't going, just until weeks ago, like 2 weeks ago, the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, was saying that Afghanistan wasn't going to fall from a Friday till a Monday. Oops. I mean, how much could that have blown up in his face? But I really recommend people read this McGovern article and really think about who's lied to you about the Afghan war and to not let those people lie to you again. You know, Pat, one of the reasons I have such a huge chip on my shoulder and I spend so much time reading about this is because when this war started, I was 11 years old and these people terrified me. I was legit scared of Muslim people growing up because they said that they were going to kill me and that we had to kill them first. And they really made me want to kill Muslim people. And so I really hold it against these bastards that they made a little kid in America feel that way with their lies. And I'm going to do everything I can to hold them accountable. Because we, you know, if they just get a hold of their status, if they just get to keep making millions in the revolving door of the military industrial complex, then you know nothing happened. At least from Afghanistan, if nothing else, we could learn a lesson. You know, take a lesson as a nation and not do something this stupid and counterproductive again. Give ourselves another Vietnam, but. If they're not held accountable, if they're not disgraced, if they're not voted out of office, if they're not, you know, if their name isn't so toxic that they can't get a contract on CNN and MSNBC, and you know, when you find out that your state government is contracting with the McChrystal Group, if people are calling their governors and saying you're giving money to the guy who lost the Afghan war, why? He got fired from running the Afghan war for being drunk and stupid, and you're giving him millions of dollars to run your state's COVID response. What is wrong with you people, right? Like, their reputation deserves to be dirt, and somebody has to make that happen. And I'm, you know, so fortunate that, you know, we have great people like Ray McGovern writing at antiwar.com. So there, you know, there's that. And I also want to recommend an article by Thomas Knapp. It's at the Garrison. I think it's the Garrison Institute. I'll send you the link for it, Pat. And he goes and really points out another thing that Americans need to do is we need to roll the military budget back. If we're not waging the war in Afghanistan, we certainly don't need to spend $750 billion next year. Now, maybe we're only going to spend $20 billion on the Afghan war, but we better sure as hell take that $20 billion out of the budget. We can't give this as just a blank check to the Pentagon and be like, oh yeah, I guess you got some extra money because the department closed. It can't work that way. Also, the $3.3 billion that were supposed to go to the Afghan National Army, that thing doesn't exist. We better not be giving that money to any armed group in Afghanistan or any armed groups. You know, that money should, I guess, you know, it's really loaned money, so it's just not going to go to an extra loan. But, you know, we can't waste our taxpayer money. We can't be negligent on this. We have to hold them accountable and take money from them because that's one of the ways that you could actually punish, you know, these kind of organizations and government institutions.
Yeah, and I mean, we've also talked a lot about, you know, the pivot to Asia and what this kind of portends. Of course, the United States still has vital, vital interests in Afghanistan. And this kind of leads into my final question for you is, like, what is the legacy of our involvement in Afghanistan? Where does this go from here? I know it's far from over and our job is not done yet. But first, my question about, you know, the U.S. still has vital interests in Afghanistan. What is our involvement going to look like there? Is the reason why we left Afghanistan, maybe if we could speculate wildly, is it to pivot to China, as I suspect that it is? And what does that look like?
So, I mean, I guess I think there's like a confluence of reasons, obviously. I will disagree, Pat. I don't think the U.S. actually has any serious interest in Afghanistan. Now, if you're talking about like maybe from the Pentagon's like grand chessboard geopolitical thing, you know, it is a country that borders Pakistan, which is an unstable nuclear weapons state. It does border Iran, which if you're a general in the Pentagon, you know, you're very concerned about. It does border China, same thing. The Central Asian stand countries, some of them are part of like the Russian military alliance. And so you could find a million reasons why, you know, Afghanistan maybe isn't a strategic region. But then I feel like you can make that argument about a lot of countries too, right? Like, if this was Ethiopia, you would be like, well, it borders Egypt, which is a critical U.S. ally, and it borders Somalia, which is one of the most unstable and decrepit states with terrorist groups, and it borders Sudan, which had a genocide going on recently. And so, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like you could make the argument by a lot of places too, but they, you know, they will make that argument. I think there's like multiple parts to this. One part is Joe Biden never believed, or at least since 2009, has not believed in the occupation of Afghanistan. He argued against it when he was vice president. He got beaten, overruled. That doesn't mean that Joe Biden is anti-war or even anti-Afghan war. He's anti-Afghan occupation. I saw on our last show, me and Will Porters, that I think he wants to turn the Afghan war into maybe a ramped up version of the Somali war. Going to carry out airstrikes, maybe some special operation raids. We're not going to base troops there. We're not going to, his idea would be not to have any soldiers die in that country. If you have them on raids, maybe they could, but, you know, minimize those kind of things and kind of wage the global war on terror more than the nation building project in Afghanistan. And so I do think that was an actual belief of Joe Biden, and I think that's probably the only reason that it ends up going through. But as you say, the pivot to Asia is also, I think, a part of this. The general need of the military to reorient some of their military assets to China. Also, I think you have a case where the military branches are kind of thinking of themselves as their own separate companies, right? So, like, all different, like, cell phone companies, like Verizon, Sprint, AT&T, you know, are the Marines, the Air Force, and the Army, right? And so, even though the, you know, current technology is what it is, and that's what people are buying, and, you know, there's still, you know, money to be made in that market, when they realize that there's a new technology on horizon, right, they all start to orient themselves to that new technology so they get the biggest piece of the market, right? And so I think, you know, like, even the Army is concerned about orienting themselves and making sure that in the future the purpose of their branch is to counter China, not to wage these Middle East wars. And so I think there's a lot of interest among even like the individual branches, the weapons makers, everyone, just to reorient towards China, because they see that's where the future is. And if you're producing products, if your branch is fighting wars in the Middle East, they're increasingly unpopular with the American people. And there are, as much as I hate to admit it, the American people are, you know, scared of China, and they, you know, want conflict to some extent with China. They're okay with spending money on U.S. military buildups to China. And so I think what, you know, they kind of see that right on the horizon, that that's going to be where the money is in the future. And so everybody wants to kind of be oriented in that direction. And to do that, you have to start to, you know, look away from where you're currently like investing and have, you know, in this case, all their troops and, you know, military resources in Afghanistan. So I kind of think that, you know, there's just so many interests. It's hard to kind of nail down exactly why it's happening. But I do think, you know, the pivot to Asia is a part of it. That's where, you know, the think tanks and the media are talking about. And it's a way that Biden, I think, is able to end the war without upsetting the odds too much, right? Because he's increasing the military budget. It's not like he's turning down wars at all. He's turning down one particular war, but he's turning up the military industrial complex overall. You know, turned the Afghan war from a 7 to, you know, a 4, but then he turned China from a 5 to a 9. And you know, that's a big problem, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, well, and don't get me wrong, of course, I don't think we have any military interest in it. In you know, any real one in Afghanistan, but maybe I'm so hung up on this idea of like doing my Uyghur issue and then Wilkerson saying what he said about Afghanistan, and to me militarily it makes a lot of sense to have people there, and then so maybe I'm trying to circle that square with my guiding beacon being, you know, Afghanistan being such an important part in this confrontation of China, but obviously not as important as, you know, maybe protecting Taiwan from their point of view, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as we have more papers, national security strategy that come from the Biden administration, we'll have a more clear view of what, you know, his agile analysts and people are thinking on the issue. But it's certainly, again, all attention towards China. I mean, what's his name? Del Toro, I forget his first name, is the nominee to be Secretary of the Navy. He said that he would focus exclusively on China, and that was a selling point. Now, that seems stupid to me, right? Like, if you're going in for a job, maybe you want to like be like, yeah, I'm going to really focus on this important branch. But if you say I'm going to focus exclusively on it, don't you think that people are going to be like, oh, you know, shouldn't you at least keep an eye on the other stuff going on? And I ain't going to be concerned about that. So it just seems to be going all in on one thing, but that is the direction so many people in Washington are going. And I mean, look, the foreign policy establishment has made one blunder and catastrophe after another. A lot of times their decisions blow up in their face and are obviously counterproductive before they do it. They're swindled by, you know, different actors like Ahmed Chalabid and so many others that we shouldn't think that what they're doing is necessarily rational or sensible, but it's going to be done. It's the government.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, thanks for that view. I mean, that really kind of solidifies my thinking on it a bit more. So if you have, do you have like three or four more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. What's your take on the legacy of Afghanistan? That's a huge
Oh, okay.
For 4 minutes.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, so it was a massive debacle, right? Like, it can't have a good leg. Like, I don't think there's any way to spin this as a positive. They could maybe spin it as less of a negative that, you know, Biden bailed out when there was maybe a near possibility of success or something like that. But into any way, say what happened in the past 20 years was good for America just clearly isn't true. I mean, you know, they'll push the safe haven myth and the idea of no major attacks, but I mean, that's so, you know, that's obviously bunk, and I won't spend a whole bunch of time going into that. But anyways, I guess it's hard to say as we're still in the moment of it, what the legacy of the war is going to be. My focus at this point is just that we hold the liars and the murderers accountable, the people who have been wrong about this war the entire time, and make sure their legacy is the legacy of the Afghan war. And look, that includes Donald Trump, who didn't end it under his administration.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said, and I know that people should follow you at Conflicts of Interest. They should follow antiwar.com, be checking that every day for these developments that are coming forward. Anywhere else that people can find your work?
The Institute, the Libertarian Institute, Pat, where you are one of the great content creators that we have on that site. You've written some great articles. Of course, Liberty Weekly is featured there. So definitely check out the Libertarian Institute. All my work ends up there. I'm the opinion editor for antiwar.com. So check out the viewpoint section, the spotlight. That's what I'm working on. I'm sure this week it's going to be pretty much all Afghanistan. We've already run great articles this week. Originals from Dub Bandow. We're going to have Scott Horton, Danny Sherzhin, Ray McGovern. We've run Daniel Larrison, Matthew Ho. We had just so many really great articles from the people who have not only been right about Afghanistan the entire time, but are still up to date on the issues. They're still the best analysts that, you know, there are, and they're writing articles for antiwar.com. And so, you know, if you want to know your stuff on Afghanistan, check that out. It is the fun drive there right now. So if you're enjoying the content, think about donating.
Hell yeah. So check us out, Libertarian Institute, Kyle. /Patrick for me and /Kyle for Kyle Anselone.
Thanks, right. Pat.
Yep, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to your coverage, and until the next time you come on.